The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Before we begin, please silence your cell phones. Also, please refrain from taking flash pictures and plan to join us upstairs afterward for the book signing. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. Ken Auletta is a prolific media reporter, critic, and New York Times bestselling author. He has penned the Annals of Communication column for The New Yorker for more than 25 years. His 11 books include the bestsellers Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way, The Highwaymen, Warriors of the Information Superhighway, and Googled, The End of the World as We Know It. One of New York Public Library's literary lions and a member of its Emergency Committee for the Research Libraries, he is also a member of the Authors Guild and the Committee to Protect Journalists. Of all the industries racked by change in the digital age, few have been turned on its head as dramatically as the global advertising business. In Frenemies, Mr. Auletta meets with old guard gatekeepers and up-and-comers to account for the profound changes to this $2 trillion global industry. He'll be joined in conversation this evening with Tracy Matysak, award-winning broadcaster and journalist. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ken Auletta and Tracy Matysak to the Free Library.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us, and welcome Ken Auletta to Philadelphia. Good to have you with us. So the book is called Frenemies, The Disruption of the Ad Industry and Just About Everything Else. And Ken, when we hear the term frenemy, we tend to think of someone that we're cordial with but maybe deep down don't like very much. What does the term frenemies mean as it relates to your book?
That's pretty close. there are two levels of frenemy. One is if you're in the ad agency business, suddenly, people who used to be your partners, let's say the publishing platforms, New York Times, Vice Media, NBC, CBS, suddenly they're not just asking you to put ads on their publishing platforms, they become ad agencies. New York Times, for instance, has 300 people in sales, and 100 of them are creating ads, going directly to the clients and bypassing the agency. PR agencies, they, as newspapers shrink, they say, hey, you know, we'll become an ad agency too. Consulting companies like Deloitte, that used to be their accountants, and McKinsey, which used to be their consultants, is now aggressively getting into the advertising business. The clients themselves are saying, why are we spending all this money? Let's take more stuff in-house. And then, of course, you got Google and Facebook, which are basically often bypassing the agencies and saying, we can help you with data that you need and deal directly with us. But the bigger frenemy, the actually existential threat to all of advertising, not just to agencies, is the public. The public increasingly doesn't want to be interrupted by ads, particularly on their mobile phones. So 20% of Americans on their mobile phones have what's called an ad blocker, which blocks out ads. And if you think about Netflix and HBO and YouTube, no ads. So a generation grows up saying we don't have to watch ads. Then you get the question, so the advertiser then says, oh, wait a second, we can get around that. We have so much data that we could tell people, hey, Ken, on your GPS, we know that you're two blocks away from Barney's. You bought a sport jacket 2 months ago. Why don't you go into Barney's, and we'll give you 20% off? And they say, that's not an ad. That's not a hard sell. That's a service to you. Well, it might be construed as a service, or it might be construed as, how the hell do you know so much about me? What about my privacy? So these are some of the conundrums. But the biggest frenemy, again, is the public that doesn't want to be interrupted.
Well, and can you bring up such a good point? Because there is, on the one hand, this, you know, just pervasiveness of ads so that, and I know many of the people in our audience have experienced this, you look up something online, and then every website you go to after that, an ad pops up for that very item right. that you were looking at, and that feels invasive. Then you get on a plane and you pull down your tray table and there's an ad on it, which feels pervasive. And so there's this tension, I think, between providing a service and being creepy, right? Where people feel like you just know way too much about me. And so how does the advertising industry navigate that tension?
They don't know. Essentially, you're talking about a world of people full of anxiety because they're being disrupted. And they know they're being disrupted, just as newspapers have known and magazines have known and the music industry people have known. And when I did my book that was mentioned earlier about the three networks, which were being disrupted by a new technology in the late 80s, which was cable TV, they knew. And so what you do is you say, oh, my God, what do I do? And there are two types of people I found. And I saw this graphically when I was doing my Google book, looking at how they were disrupting the world of newspapers and magazines and media. There are people who lean back and say, oh, my God, oh, woe is me. This is just terrible. What a problem digital presents to us. And I don't know what to do about it, but we got to keep trying, but I don't know. Then there are people who lean forward and they say, I'm not going to call digital a problem. I'm going to call it an opportunity, and I'm going to try and figure out. So I'm going to throw stuff against the wall and see what sticks. Smart people in the advertising world are doing that. They're throwing stuff against the wall and see what sticks. We don't yet know what's going to stick, and we don't know about issues like privacy. We don't know how the public will react to things like artificial intelligence, which allows them to even know more about you and to psych you out as a consumer in ways that you may not approve of. Will we do what Western Europe has just done? 28 nations of Western Europe have imposed a privacy law that basically says they cannot collect your cookies, meaning the data that you have, and which is how they collect, they know so much about us. You can't, unless the person chooses to opt in. In America, you have to opt out for them not to have access to your cookies. Opting out is really complicated, deliberately so. And on the other hand, if you choose to opt in, and many people don't choose to opt in, what happens to advertising? And one of the things I learned in reporting this book, advertising really matters. I mean, I may have disdain for some ads and the emotional manipulation that we undergo because of those ads, and the fact they don't tell you anything about the product, they're just meant to move you emotionally. But the fact of the matter is, without advertising dollars, there's no Facebook. 97% of Facebook's revenues come from advertising. Google, no Google. 90% of their revenues come from advertising. Forget newspapers, forget broadcast TV, forget magazines. And then people say, well, we'll go to a subscription model. We'll get rid of ads, right? Well, think about that. The math really doesn't work. The one thing that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton agreed on is that the middle class and the working class of this country, which is the bulk of the population, had their incomes frozen for the last decade. They can't afford subscriptions. And the average home subscription cost is roughly $260 a month, and that doesn't include electricity and gas and some other things. So how are people going to pay for Facebook? Are people going to pay for Google? Are people going to eliminate all advertising at the New York Times? I don't think so.
So it doesn't look like the subscription model will work, and yet the stakes are so high because you've got entire industries that are fully dependent on advertising.
Right.
I want to talk a little bit about the impact of social media. We've seen some cases lately where we've seen advertisers actually running away from certain shows, from certain platforms. I think about Samantha Bee, Laura Ingraham as two recent examples. Can you talk a little bit about the role that social media plays in where advertisers decide to invest or perhaps to pull back?
Well, what happens, things become viral, and it's not always clear why they do. Roseanne became viral. Bill O'Reilly became viral. And advertisers, he was really canceled because the advertisers canceled on him. If you think about it, if there's an air crash, all the ads for on the newscast that night relating to airlines will be automatically pulled. Why? Because essentially an advertiser demands that I want to have my friendly ad in a friendly environment. And if Bill O'Reilly is not a friendly environment, or Samantha Bee is not, or Laura Ingraham is not, even if it's momentary, they want to pull, many will pull their ads. Now, that could be scary, because I mean, you go through periods in our history where advertisers wouldn't advertise on black anchored shows, et cetera, et cetera. But they have that power to do that, and it's magnified by the fact that a mistake or a racist comment by Roseanne will just go viral within minutes, and social networks will just pound away at it. And the advertisers get scared, and they say, it's unfriendly, I want to get away.
Well, you mentioned Roseanne, and of course Ambien struck back after she blamed Ambien for the tweets that she made about Valerie Jarrett. And I wonder what you thought about Ambien's decision to defend itself while also kind of taking a shot at a celebrity.
Well, I mean, I thought there were two really brilliant responses on the Roseanne situation. One was Ambien basically saying there's no known scientific evidence that Ambien causes racist behavior. And the other was the ABC, when Donald Trump tweeted and attacked, he basically subtly defended Roseanne by not mentioning her name, but he said, how come when someone attacks them or says something they don't like, they pull her off the air? But in my case, all these people who've attacked me on ABC or ESPN, they're quiet. They never say a word about it. And he was goading ABC and Disney to go after him, and they were silent. They didn't respond. I thought that was a brilliant way to deal with Donald Trump.
Yeah. You devote an entire chapter in the book to comparing the current advertising environment to the Mad Men days of the 60s and how we've gone from the Mad Men to the Math, M-A-T-H, men. And I'm wondering how you feel that calculus, if you will, has disrupted creativity as the math men have taken over.
Well, if you think about it, the future is you're going to get away from 30-second spots. You're not going to be able to do them on a small screen on your mobile phone, and it eats up too much battery. It's also, you know, too much of an interruption. So increasingly, the advertisers and the clients are combining to say, well, we have to figure out other ways to get messages. Maybe instant messages. Maybe instant messengers that are crafted by a machine based on artificial intelligence, you know, a line or two. Maybe we don't need the Don Drapers, the Mad Men to do this. Maybe we could do it, and our machines could do it much more efficiently. And that is a rising tension in this world between the old mad men who believe in their gut, in instinct. I mean, I remember George Lois, I don't remember, I wasn't there, but he's one of the legendary figures in the advertising world. He's still alive, actually. He's probably 90. And he believed that the advertiser had to follow his instinct and his judgment. By the way, Bill Birnbach, another legendary guy who created the Volkswagen ads and the Levy's, you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's rye bread, he was the same way. He believed that I am a madman, I am a talented, creative person, and I know I have an expertise you don't have, follow me. And one day, George Lois, when the client balked at one of the ads he proposed, he started screaming. He's a big, tall guy, and he started screaming. He said, if you don't take this ad, I'm going to jump out this window. And, of course, the client took the ad.
Ken, talk a little bit about the scale of domination that Google and Facebook have achieved. You mentioned just a few minutes ago how something like 90% of their revenue is dependent on advertising, but that they are also frenemies of the ad industry. Talk about the scale of domination and how they've been able to sort of predict future behavior. You know, you talk about surveillance capitalism in the book.
Well, I mean, they just have, there are three companies that really know a lot about you. If you think about the five giant digital companies, exclude Microsoft, which really isn't in the advertising business, exclude Apple, which is also not in the advertising business. If you think about Google Search, Search tells you, and they have all this data, everything you've searched, everything you've gone through, everything you've read online, they have that in your cookies, and they know that about you. The machines know that. In Facebook's case, everything you talk to about your friends, you know, the subjects that come up, they have that. Again, that's very valuable information. Who has the most valuable information? And the company that is aggressively starting to get into the advertising business for the first time? Amazon. Mm-hmm. Amazon knows everything you've purchased. That's the most valuable data for advertisers want to know. And so these three companies are coming at each other, and they're all investing heavily in artificial intelligence. They're all investing heavily in at-home Alexa, thing. That little device knows an awful lot. It's basically, they're not listening in your conversations, but they know what time you wake up, what you order, when you go to sleep. I mean, they just know a lot about you, and that is valuable information that advertisers covet. They love to have that. And Amazon and Google, Amazon will, but Google now and Facebook now, shield that. The advertisers call it their walled garden. They won't open up their garden to us. They'll give us some information, but not all information. And they don't give all information. They claim it's because of privacy concerns. That's not really the reason. They don't give it because it's a proprietary interest that they retain that. But these companies have enormous dominance. Google and Facebook alone, 75% of all the digital ads are on just those two platforms. And by the way, it's over $70 billion a year. More money is spent on these two, on digital ads today, than is spent on television, which has always been the champion receiver of ad dollars. And one of the reasons why companies like Vice and companies like BuzzFeed, these digital upstarts that seem to be thriving, are suddenly laying off people, is because the money is being diverted to the Googles and the Facebook, and soon to the Amazons. Yeah.
And Amazon certainly has been a huge disruptor of retail itself. I mean, you can go into any mall and see, the empty storefronts, and so much of commerce has gone online, and that has to have had an impact on advertising as well.
Oh, it has. Oh, no, there's no question it has. I mean, there's been a... First of all, department stores close, and so there's less advertising there. But, one of the things, this is not uncomplicated. When I mentioned cookies and their ability to collect this data, there's some good things that are involved in them collecting that data. For instance, when you go to Amazon and you purchase books and they tell you, Ken, people who've purchased this book have also purchased. It's almost the equivalent of browsing in a bookstore. I like that service. You wouldn't get that if you didn't have the cookies. When I do a search on Google, and it knows, anticipates what I'm searching for because they know my search history, it saves me time. Yeah. So I like the fact they have access to that cookie. So it's not uncomplicated. And further, to tell you how complicated it gets in my mind, if you spend time with engineers, as I have, in reporting both the Google book and this book, what is it the engineer thinks he or she is doing as they're collecting this data? They call it big data. They think they are serving the public. They think that by massaging and collecting all this data, they are helping unlock the secrets to consumer behavior, to make our lives a little more simpler and a little more efficient, maybe cutting out extraneous middlemen who add to expenses that maybe you don't need, right? Like taxi cab drivers or Uber or hotels for Airbnb. But these are people who take great pride in being able to massage this data and unlock these secrets. They don't think about privacy. They're just thinking about this is good for business. At some point, you start pressing them, as we witness the Congress asking questions of Mark Zuckerberg, and suddenly they're compelled to say, hey, wait a second. Stop, Zuckerberg. What about privacy? And, of course, Zuckerberg is not a person who's thought deeply about privacy at all. I mean, in fact, if you go back and look at his early statements in starting Facebook, he was basically saying, isn't it wonderful that we can all share information and everything is transparent? Well, it's not so wonderful. You know, when we look at your kids, our kids, and we say, what is she or he doing on Facebook? And are they saying things that are going to come back to haunt them when they seek a job?
Yeah.
So it's there is an idealism that I found at the Google and Facebook engineers, and even in the Zuckerberg and Larry Page and Sergey Brin people. But that idealism is now getting wiped away by the reality, by people asking questions about privacy, by people asking, what are you doing to my kid's brain all the time that he or she is spending staring at this machine?
Yeah. And the privacy concerns are huge. You mentioned GDPR a few minutes ago in Europe and the whole opting in and opting out. Do you see something like that coming to the United States?
I don't know. We don't have the same history of concern for privacy here as they do in Germany and much of Western Europe. It's always been a political issue where the public is ahead of the public figures there. We don't have that history here. Will we get it now? Will people become more alarmed? I don't know. That's a question.
Yeah. So can you spotlight a number of the heavy hitters in the advertising industry throughout your book? And one of them is the former WPP CEO, Martin Sorrell, who was the one who, I believe, coined the term frenemies.
No, he didn't, right? Actually. He likes to say he did. He didn't. I did some research on that. The frenemies, it was also spelled differently. He spelled it. It was coined by of all people, Walter Winchell, in 1948. And Winchell was talking about the United States' biggest frenemy, the Soviet Union. We need alliances with them and peace with them, and yet they're an adversary of ours. Martin Sorrell has popularized it, to his credit. He talks about it all the time. And in less about the public being the frenemy than the consulting companies and the Googles and the Facebook. But Martin Sorrell was a guy who started WPP, which is the largest advertising holding company, 33 years ago. It is the first economically successful holding company. There have been others, but this is one that was the first to be successful financially. And he built the company of over 400 companies, many of which he bought, some in hostile takeovers, like Ogilvy and Mather and others. I asked him in the last chapter, I said, Mr. Sorrell, you're going to be 73 years old shortly. When will you leave? When do you think you'll step down? And he said, they'll have to shoot me to get me out of here. Well, 2 months after the book was finished, they shot him.
In effect, right?
And he's out. And there's actually a big story in the Financial Times today, I just read online, speculating as to why. I called him. He was ousted after my book was printed. It was at the printer, but before the e-book was, or the digital copy, so I was able to add some stuff. But I called him. I didn't call him. I emailed him. He's a guy, despite the fact that he had 400 people reporting to him, if you email Martin Sorrell, within 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you'd get an email response on his BlackBerry. He still uses a BlackBerry. And if you see him at tennis matches, he doesn't watch the match. He does his emails. And he said, I signed a non-disclosure agreement. I can't talk. And the board said the same thing. But now, obviously, The board has a PR agency, and that's what I smell, that they're leaking stuff. Of course, they have a public shareholder meeting on Wednesday, and I think they're trying to defend themselves and maybe make him a little smelly. And so the story in the Financial Times said, A, that he was, I don't know whether it's true, because I've been hearing all kinds of rumors, you know, from people peddling rumors about him. I don't know whether it's true or not. They said, A, he was rough on his people, which is true. That I know is true because I saw it. And alienated much of the staff, his personal staff, by that. And that supposedly he was spotted by two members of his staff going into a house of prostitution in London. Whether that's true, I don't know. I mean, he's married, second marriage to a very attractive woman. They just had a baby last year. Is it true? I don't know. But in any case, and the argument was that somehow corporate funds, they said a non-material amount, which is what the board has publicly said. What is a non-material amount in a $21 billion company? I don't know. And I don't know whether this is true, but there's a huge story in the Financial Times, and they by two really good reporters, and they obviously spent a lot of time reporting this.
Speaking of huge stories, before we get to our audience questions for you, I have to ask you, I had heard that you had attempted several times to break the Harvey Weinstein story, that you worked on that yourself for a number of years before the New York Times and Ronan Farrow actually brought it to print. Tell us about how that played out.
I profiled Harvey Weinstein in 2002. It was a 20,000-word piece. I spent a lot of time with him. Brilliant guy. I mean, editing movies and stuff, you watch him, he was really brilliant. An awful human being. And so I wrote a story about what a bully he was to people, and it was all on the record. There was no anonymous quotes in this. It was people like Stacey Snyder, who's now the head of Fox Studios, talking about how he physically threatened her, and Barry Diller confirming it, and et cetera. Julie Taymor, the director, you know, him threatening her mate with physical violence. So I confronted him in our last interview. I had a fair amount of information about one, a woman he allegedly raped during Shakespeare in Love, which was in 98. Another woman, his assistant, who I tracked down to Uruguay. And I had a number of stories of awful things he had done, all anonymous. And I confronted him, it was just the two of us in our final interview. You save your nasty questions till the end, knowing you'll never get another interview after that. And so I said, Harvey, tell me about what happened with, and I named the woman who was raped and the woman, his assistant. And did you rape her? Did you threaten the other one? Did you pay $500,000, $250 each, to silence them and get them to sign non-disclosure agreements? One of the things I couldn't figure out as I'm doing the Harvey reporting is how come I go to courts in the U.S. and the courts in France and the courts in England, and there's no public documents about this. And then I realized what he did. And this has not been reported. I don't know why. I've told it to the Times and Ronan as well. What he did was, if you're willing to pay any amount of money, you have your lawyer go to the women and say, Mr. Weinstein is willing to settle. How much would you like? Would $250,000 be sufficient? Sign this non-disclosure agreement, and I get to keep it. You don't get a copy. So it's not a public document because it never went to court. It remains a private document. So we had to make a decision. I had to then see my next question in a summit meeting with Harvey, and David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, and I met with Harvey and his brother and their lawyer, and we had our lawyer. And I said, Harvey, I need to see the canceled checks, these two canceled checks. Of course, I was saying, if the company paid for it, or if Disney, which was then his corporate parent, paid, I'm going to send someone to jail with this story, you know, and they should go to jail. The next day came back, he started screaming, and actually when I confronted him in the conference room, just the two of us, I thought we were going to get into a fist fight, because he stood up and with his fist clenched over me, and I was seated, and I got up and we're roughly the same height, and I stood facing him. And at that moment, thinking he might throw a punch at me, I was kind of hoping he would. And I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. And he started to cry. It was the most extraordinary thing. And what he said was, these were consensual affairs. These were not what has been alleged. And so then we had to make a decision after seeing the canceled checks, which were personal checks, not corporate checks. And after saying it was consensual, and he had three kids and a wife, and I had zero women on the record or men on the record. Are we the National Enquirer at the New York or not? And we decided, Remnick decided, and I agreed. We couldn't publish it. So we didn't have we had the bullying and a tough story on him. But, and then what happened was, and I tried again, I'll speed this up, to nail him for sexual predation in 2015 on two different occasions. Again, I couldn't get anyone to go on the record. Ronan Farrow called me up in the spring of last spring and said, Ken, your papers are on, I've given my papers and tape recordings to New York Public Library. Can I have access to them on Harvey Weinstein? After he talked to me and I saw he was a smart guy, I said, sure. So he had access to me. He calls me up. He says, can I come and interview you? I said, sure, but you're going to have to come out to Bridgehampton because I'm finishing a book. And he came out with a producer and two cameras for MSNBC. And he asked me great questions. And he told me he had a total of eight women, five not on camera, but talking, you know, their voices, you can hear their voices, and three on camera by name. Plus, he had the audio tape, which I couldn't get in 2015, of the Italian model who Harvey supposedly grabbed her breasts and tried to seduce in the hotel, and she ran away. I said, great. What's the next step? He said, I meet with NBC News the first week in August, and we'll get a decision. And so I emailed him the second week in August, and I said, so how'd you do? And he said, they turned it down. And they said it wasn't graphic enough for TV. I said, wow. And so then I put him in touch with Remnick and The New Yorker.
Wow. And the story blew up from there.
And then he did. I never knew it after that. He just did it all.
Yeah.
The kid is amazing. I mean, he graduated college at 15, graduated Yale Law School at 17, got a Rhodes Scholarship. This year, with all the reporting he's done, he not only won a Pulitzer for that, but he's written a best-selling book, which is a damn good book about diplomacy. I mean, and he just turned 30.
And he's the son of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen.
No, his dad, is, they say, is Andre Previn. He looks just like Sinatra.
Really? Interesting. There's fake news floating around on the internet.
I don't think the chronology works. But anyway, he's in a sensational report. He has a photographic memory.
Yeah.
And he's modest. I mean, and some people say, well, you know, and the same thing with the brilliant Times reporters who did this. They say, well, it wouldn't have happened if not for Roger Ailes and Bill Cosby and all the things. And that the culture did shift. There's no question about that. But these are great reporters with great empathy. And the women they talked to, they made them feel comfortable, secure, that they were going to nail this guy, this predator. And they did.
Wow. Well, on that note, what do you say we open up the floor for your questions for Ken Auletta? We've got some staff members who have microphones, so just raise your hands and we'll get a microphone to you and you can ask your question for Ken.
Hi, Ken. And Tracy, great questions, great everything thus far, very entertaining. I want to go back to advertising, right back to the book.
You tired of Harvey? Ready?
No. I
am.
You are. What I'm wondering is that the institution, and I think you might have done a good job at the beginning of sort of framing and saying, you know, let's not kid ourselves. This is a very large industry in terms of its dimensions, and Lord only knows the extent of its influence on us, you know, known and unknown, just the seepage and just everything. It's a powerful force, and in their own way, they are storytellers. And in their own way, they've had a rather significant role in shaping our culture, for better, for worse, but a general sense of reflecting the culture and perhaps the stories that come out of our culture, who we are, how we think of ourselves. As there's this shrinkage going on that you're describing, trying to communicate in this very small space, trying to tell those stories in ever shorter snaps, how is the industry, given its storied past, how do you think it's holding up today in those changed circumstances? Is the storytelling still alive? Do they still have it? What does the industry feel like today to you in that regard?
Well, it used to be that you would introduce a brand. A brand would become famous because of television ads. That doesn't happen anymore. Startups don't have that kind of money, or they don't feel they're as effective to do that, so they don't invest. And it's a real problem. In 2016, this book began in 15, and so it went through this winter. But there was a big rush with this belief in the ad community and the publishing community that the answer to the problem of ad blockers and the answer to the problem of people who don't want to be interrupted was, let's trick them. Let's do something called native advertising. Native advertising is essentially an advertorial, but it's a story. And instead of being heavy-handed by saying, brought to you by Procter & Gamble or Gillette or something, it's a story about Gillette, written in typeface that looks like a news story. And so it's storytelling. And that's what those 100 or so people at the Times who were in the sales department who were creating ads, most of them were creating native ads. And there was a belief that native advertising would get around the ad blockers, would also be a way of reaching people on their cell phones with a different form of ad, because they would think it was a story. And it hasn't been as successful as anticipated back in 2016. But people will try in other things. They're going to try and figure out, how do we do creative advertising? How do we build a brand? How do we do things that will capture people's attention and not feel like an interruption? Storytelling is obviously going to be a big part of that, whether it's native ads or something else. But again, we're in this formative period. We don't know what the answer is right now. But they're trying lots of different things.
Thank you. Mr. Oletta, the worst day of the week for me is Thursday, because that's when my New Yorker comes, and I realize I haven't read the last four or five. So I would imagine most people here today subscribe to the New Yorker. I realize this is a little bit of an open-ended question, but what's it like to work there? It's just such a wonderful magazine to read every week.
I had my first piece for the New Yorker appeared in 78, and it was a two-parter on New York City union contracts and mismanagement in New York. And the fact checker, I'm answering your question, by the way. I was getting married that night. The fact checker came to my apartment to fact check with me. My wife-to-be said, Martin was a former professor at Columbia. That's the level of fact checkers you had. Martin, you have to leave now. We're getting married in 2 hours. And the fact checking, everyone there is out to make your work better. From the fact checker to the copy editor to your actual editor. I mean, David Remnick, for instance, the editor-in-chief, I don't know how he does it. And Mr. Sean was the same way, the legendary Mr. Sean, William Sean. You would hand your piece in to them, they would read it, and maybe two or three more times in different galleys they would read the story again. Plus and they're doing this to all the writers, and they're writing their own. In Remnick's case, he's probably more prolific than most writers at the New Yorker. I don't know how the son of a gun does it. But you feel like everyone is trying to make your work better. And it's a happy place. I work at home. I like to be near my refrigerator. And so I don't go there very much, except when I'm closing a piece. You send it in electronically. And I've never wanted an office there because I get up at 5. I like to work early and sometimes work late. And you don't want to go to the office is on Wall Street. Not Wall Street, it's in World Trade Center. And I don't want to work in one of those sterile buildings at 9 o'clock at night or 5 o'clock, and I got cartons of research and stuff. But a lot of people like that. For me, it would be, I would be at too many lunches, too many schmooze fests, and I wouldn't get any work done. But it's a great place. It's an unusual place. That answer your question?
This is back to advertising. Do you see a trend developing where a greater portion of the population turns off advertising? And if so, and you mentioned native ads, but what are companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook, what they must be perceiving this as a potential trend as well. What are they looking for in terms of how they then subsidize their businesses?
I think they feel less threatened by, the answer is yes. The public increasingly is being turned off. I'll throw out another statistic. People who have a PVR and record shows on their PVR from the cable box, according to Nielsen, 54% who record a program skip the ads when they watch the program. That's a stunning figure. And by the way, TiVo says it's 65%. But anyway, it's a majority of people who record shows skip the ads. So there's no question that that is happening. It's less of a menace right now to Google and Facebook. They have those little ads on the right-hand side. And Larry Page, when I was doing my Google book, said to me that half the people who click on an ad see the ad as informational, not as an ad. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're less threatened than TV advertising, newspaper, magazine, and radio advertising is. But, you know, they also, they're not reliant on the creative ad. They know the banner ads and the pre-roll ads, they're dinosaurs. They really annoy the public, and they have evidence of that. But the text ads on the side, and the advertisers love it at Google, you know, because you don't pay, you do an auction, and the one who offers the biggest price is at the top of the right hand and then next, right? But the advertiser is not charged unless the person clicks on the ad. And if the person clicks on the ad, the advertiser now has a direct relationship, knows your email, has a direct relationship with you. And they love, so they're less threatened by this than everyone else would be.
I remember you actually from the Samuels campaign in New York in 1970. And given that, I'd like to ask you about political ads and how this affects the politics in advertising and making people aware of candidates and where they can advertise and what they do.
A voice from my past here. Your life takes twists and turns, unexpected twists and turns. I had a graduate degree in political science, and I thought I would be, you know, work in government. And so I worked for this guy, Howard Samuels, and with my help, he lost for governor. And he was a wonderful man. And he was called the upstate industrialist. When he was at MIT, he invented the plastic clothesline there and later invented baggies. So he was a very interesting character. There's pressure, as we've witnessed, because in Facebook, because of the Russian scandal, and I think it's fair to call it the Russian scandal, that they have to do a better job of policing ads. There's a number of bills in the Congress that basically say you have to disclose who you are. And if you go back and think of Mark Zuckerberg last fall, when people said the Russians had a big influence and with fake news and stuff on his social networks, he said, quote, "That's a crazy idea. Didn't happen." Well, he's since rescinded that crazy idea and agrees that it happened. So there's pressure, and I think that Facebook will be compelled and will try and do it, some of it voluntarily, to better police political ads. But the impetus in the media community, election years are their gold mines. They produce huge revenues. This election year, huge. Presidential years, bigger. And so they want to have some limits. You know, we don't want to discourage revenue here for us, is their attitude. But there will be changes, and it's happening before our eyes.
If you were CEO of an advertising agency, what would be your business plan?
I just quit. I'll tell you one of the things I would do, and I think I would do this in any business, not just advertising, and I'm shocked how little of it goes on. If you look at the success of social networks and the success of some advertising campaigns that are two-way, it's basically you're not just speaking to, which is the interruptive ad that annoys people, but if you can engage people and get them talking back, that's what Facebook is meant to be, and one of the reasons why they have 2.2 billion customers. I would, if I were in an organization, I would make it my business to have a two-way conversation with the people who work for me, and from executives to lower. What ideas do you have? What do you think we should be doing? And there are people who have ideas in your organization, and they're not tapped. And I'm always stunned at how little of this goes on in the businesses I write about as a journalist. I'm just stunned at how one way it is, and therefore it's not thoughtful. It's stupid. So that's one of the that would be one of the first things I would do. Someone asked me this morning, and I gave a I was speaking at a conference this morning in New York, where I was being interviewed like. Not as well, by the way, as I'm being interviewed by you. And they asked, "What would you do for the if you?" They didn't say if you were CEO, but they said, "What would you do if you?" And what should advertising do? And the truth is, I don't know what they should do. I mean, the true answer is that if I had 14 points, I don't. And I don't know anyone who does. And it's all a question, again, of throwing things against the wall and being humble enough to say, I got to listen and maybe I'll learn some things. I bring in, not just the, you have lots of ad agencies who work in these holdings. There are five giant holding companies. They have dozens of agencies of all kinds, marketing agencies as well as. The figure in the world is that an estimated up to $2 trillion is spent worldwide on advertising and marketing. Advertising is roughly a $500 to $600 billion worldwide business. The rest is marketing. So almost three quarters is marketing. That's direct mail. It's instant messages. It's PR. It's lobbying, et cetera. And coupons, placement on Aragon, shelf space in supermarkets, all that is part of marketing. So you got a lot of people to talk to who know a lot of different things. And, I'm just stunned that Martin Sorrell, for instance, a brilliant guy. I mean, just really brilliant. And a guy who was out there always soaking up information, talking to people. And more so than his contemporaries did in the other holding companies. But I don't think he had two-way conversations internally. And he should have.
Impression, it may be wrong, that a lot of the ad companies are trying to kind of usurp the social media. You know, people are already on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and they're, the soap company has a Facebook page and tries to interact. How successful have those efforts been, do you think, or do you know?
One of the things that is being successful is increasingly, companies are saying we have to have a direct relationship with the consumer. And Dollar Shave Club, for instance, Unilever buys the Dollar Shave Club for $1 billion. And Dollar Shave Club literally communicates two-way with consumers, and they're great consumer service. But they have a direct relationship they have with their people, just the way some car dealers do, you know, people who lease cars or purchase cars. But in Dollar Shave Club, it's even more aggressive than that. And Procter & Gamble has bought some companies. They're all doing that and trying to do that to so that if advertising doesn't work, they can directly communicate with, you know, the equivalent of Facebook, have two-way communication with their loyal customers and make them feel like they're part of the team.
I'm thinking about Charlie Rose. Now, you know, you mentioned that they pulled the advertisers pulled, you know, their dollars from the shows, O'Reilly and Charlie Rose. Do you think possibly if the mea culpa type thing, you know, Jimmy Swaggart did it years ago, I've sinned, you know, and he's come back, he's on television. Of course, he's self-funded in a sense, you know, but do you think it's a possibility if they had a real act of contrition to the public that they actually be able to come back on the air? I do miss Charlie Rose, I got to tell you right now.
You right. Should. Charlie Rose, you know, and if you watch television, it's very hard to finish a sentence. Charlie allowed people to finish a paragraph. And he was very good, and he had a wide array of guests and subjects. But the Washington Post did two stories on him and produced Women by Name who talked about his behavior, unacceptable behavior. I know Charlie a long time and respect him as a talent, but he, you know, his behavior is not excusable. Now, he will say that he didn't do these things, but that's a lot of testimony from a lot of different women willing to go on the record by reputable reporters. It's very hard to see how, and Charlie's 76, it's very hard to see how he's going to come back. And it's very hard to see how, you know, how some of the other folks who've been named, Mario Batali, and he's a new set of stories came out on him just last week about rape and at the Spotted Pig restaurant. Yeah. And you know, on the other hand, if you look at the story done on Tom Brokaw, this not, I mean, it should not have been given the wide play it got compared to the Matt Lauer story or the Harvey Weinstein and Roger Ailes story. It was basically an accusation by a woman that he tried to kiss her, and you know, he didn't try to harm her career or put his hand down her pants or rape her, and as some of these other people did. So I think we have to distinguish, and in the fever of the moment, it's very hard to distinguish because what's coming out is all these terrible things that have been done and have been perceived as normal by men, and they're not normal, and they should be punished and changed, and so there's going to be some people who will suffer more than they should based on what the accusation against them were, but there'll be people who will suffer and should and will not get reformed, will not. It's very hard. I mean, I remember Mario Batali, I don't know the man, but I've read that he, at first he thought he would lay low, then he thought he would go to Africa and serve, do public service there and then come back, and then the story appears last week or 2 weeks ago about him literally raping people. Yeah, forget it. Goodbye, Mario Batali.
Oh, yeah. I just have a general question about not knowing a lot about the advertising business. If you've had these bigger companies who were probably flush with more cash back in the day when they had more influence with maybe more of the money going to in-house operations, does that make the advertising business more conservative? Has that affected the product when you have less money to throw around? Do you kind of stick to what works and there's less innovation? Has that been a thing that in your research you've noticed? Or I guess in general, what are the trends that you're seeing as business models are changing?
So let me be sure I'm responding to the question you're asking. Because of the size and power of the holding companies, do I see an impact on the politics of the country or on their on what political do they impose political values on the advertiser?
No, not politically, just in general. When, you know, I guess, do you make more conservative decisions? Do you go to tried and true things that have worked in the past and have brought in revenue and innovate less when I guess, you're not making as much money and that there are different ways to get advertisements out there with a lot of things being done in-house?
I don't know how to respond to that. One of the things that's really different about advertising and today is that if you think about it, what's the difference between toothpaste? Is there really different? They're really a commodity. There's really no difference. The thing that tells the difference is the ads. And increasingly, because there's so many ads out there, and because the public is kind of fed up with all those interruptions, the advertiser is saying, we have to cloak ourselves in some kind of public good. So if you watch a Colgate ad in the Super Bowl, 30 seconds, never mention toothpaste. They mention the environment. Don't leave your water running all the time. Conserve water. There are many parts of the world where people don't have water. And increasingly, you will see companies, Unilever, which is one of the second largest advertiser in the world, they increasingly talk about the environment and how their products are good for the environment. And they sell some of the sausage-making businesses because they're not healthy for you. So increasingly, advertisers are trying to differentiate themselves by offering themselves the public good they do, which arguably is political in the sense that it's not necessarily something that a strict conservative would like to see done. On the other hand, it's not really political in the sense of being polarizing. And if you try to typecast them as liberal or progressive, they would recoil at that. That's a partial answer to your question. I can't give a fuller one because I'm not sure, you know, what the correct answer is to that.
Well, it will be interesting to see how the industry navigates all of these new challenges that are coming so rapid fire, especially because of technology. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Ken Auletta for a wonderful, eye-opening conversation. And thanks to all of you for being here. Ken will be signing your books in just a few minutes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.